May the spirit of discernment be with us tonight and grant us a perception of the meaning of this story for our lives. As I shared last night, there are two skeletons in the Anabaptist closet. The first one I shared was the story of Munster, and it's squarely in the Dutch-Russian part of the story. Now, the group is larger tonight, so I would like to know how many of you sitting here tonight have a Dutch-Russian origin? I see your hands. One, two. Still only two. Three. Okay. Well, the second skeleton in the closet is in... It's the story of how Mennonites became good Nazis. And it is in Germany, but it does include the Swiss Germans this time, as well as the Dutch Russians. Now, here's the connection. When the Mennonites who originated in Holland went to the Vistula River area, Prussia, the people who did not move on to Russia become the direct part of the story. The people who went on to Russia missed this story. And the people who did not go to America, the people who stayed, in both parties became the people, the progenitors of the people in our story tonight. So without further ado, let's get started. Matters if it really matters if this is on or not. I don't need to have it, the lights off, but it's up to you. Memory is a conscious work of interpretation, marked as much by deletion as by selection. How a community remembers its past is the single most important element in determining its future. Now, the story I'm going to tell you tonight is so awful that people have just simply not talked about it. I have in my hands right here the first official meeting to discuss this that happened in 2015. The Mennonite Nazi story just needed to be forgotten, and it's just now coming out. In fact, this came out in Mennonite World Review. The title is a meeting in a conference, Mennonites in the Era of National Socialism. It was held September 25 through 28 of 2015, less than 2 years ago. It's the first public occasion since the end of World War II that Mennonites from Germany, Switzerland, Paraguay, the Netherlands, and the former Soviet Union spoke openly about their experiences. I'll talk more about it later. Here are three words: American, Mennonite, and Christian. And so you fit in this box. So are you sitting here tonight a Mennonite Christian American? Are you a Christian American Mennonite? Or are you an American Mennonite Christian? Or doesn't it matter? What do you think? I would like somebody to give me some kind of response on that. Which one are you? You're Christian first. You mean this one? Okay, well, anybody else? Thank you. You went to school. Okay, in school we try to teach that nouns are the stronger words and adjectives are the weaker. And so I hope that all of us sitting here are Christian first. And I'm not sure if it really matters whether we're American Mennonite Christian or a Mennonite American Christian. That part I don't know if it really matters that much. Okay, the story we have tonight is the story where people decided that it was important to be German first and Christian second. Locating this geographically, this is Germany. This is East Germany. So we're talking about this area right here, which is just north of Switzerland and just east of France. And here's Belgium. So it's Germany is just east of Belgium. Over here is England. Here's Ireland. Looking at it closer, here is Switzerland. And whenever we got persecuted, we Swiss German people, we went north and we lived in the Palatinate. Here, both sides of the Rhine River, in Germany, partly in France, but we had remnants in Germany when the Nazis came through. Of course, this is Greater Germany, and this is the area where the what we call the Dutch-Russian people, as they were persecuted, tended to move east. These are the people who stayed, as I said earlier. And so what I have to share tonight is the thought that ideas have consequences. In biblical terminology, sowing, given time, produces reaping. Or scientifically, a cause, given time, produces an effect. The reaping is in direct relation to the sowing. The effect is in direct consequence of the cause. So never let anybody tell you that what you think doesn't matter. By the mid-1700s, the Mennonites in Germany were losing their Anabaptist worldview. They spent 100 years losing their non-resistance. And if you'd like to read the story of how that happened, this is a rather new book, Mennonite German Soldier by Mark Jansen. Nation, Religion, and Family in the Prussian East from 1772 to 1880. And it details very well how they lost their non-resistance one step at a time, so that by 1900 they were ready to take up arms. In World War I, I don't know how many of actually went into the war, World War I, but 400 German Mennonite soldiers died. But they had come to love the martial spirit of their times. Anabaptism to them was cold and stodgy and stagnant, but the Prussian martial spirit, straight backs, fresh uniforms, martial music, marching, it was exciting and dashing and daring. And it seemed to the young men that this was progress to be a part of the new martial spirit of the times. So they went to war. The Prussian-German Mennonites were mostly assimilated in Prussia by the late 1800s and desired to partake of all the positive elements of being German and wanted to participate fully in German society. Now you'll notice in many of these slides that I show you tonight, there's a reference down here. When I went to search this out, the librarian told me, I'll put this one back on. She said, obviously what you're looking for, we don't put out front. And when I started checking, then I understood a little bit more why she said, we don't put this out front. And so here, what I had to look for is unpublished dissertations. The research is done. It's just now beginning to be actually published. Here is a 1981 issue, March of Mennonite Life, where we do have something published, and this is unusual, in 1981, the story of Nazism and its reception by German Mennonites. So I credit that. That's a public magazine. Here is The Mennonite. This is March 2012, Walking the Way of Peace. And the article here is Mennonites and the Holocaust by Gerhard Rempel. Gerhard Rempel is dedicating his life and energies to exposing the story. If any of you would like to search any of this out or see me afterwards, I have more to show you as far as the sources. Mennonite Quarterly Review, October 2010, includes a story that I'll refer to later on, Mennonites and the Holocaust, From Collaboration to Perpetuation, by the same man, Gerhard Rempel. On the other hand, the Mennonites wanted to maintain the cultural and religious traditions that gave them a strong sense of group identity and a strong sense of connection with their cherished history. So they're conflicted. On one hand, they want to be a total part of the German society, but on the other hand, they remember their tradition. But the two don't fit together. The Prussian Mennonites were familiar with the martyr's mirror, but they chose to believe that the past did not apply to the present. The martyr stories were good for that day, but not applicable for the present day. Now, does that sound familiar at all? The German Mennonites outgrew their Anabaptist forefathers, such as Menno Simons. Instead, they adopted the ideas of Julius Wellhausen, a German rationalist scholar. His higher criticism claimed that the Bible was a sublime collection of human documents. Human reason was to be trusted, but not the supernatural claims of the Bible. And so these people decided that progress meant moving this way, and enlightenment meant believing this kind of thing. A culture cannot lose its philosophic center without the most serious of consequences, not just to the philosophy on which it was based, but to the whole superstructure of culture and even each person's notion of who he or she is. Everything changes. With leadership from Lutheran and Baptist-trained pastors who encouraged state-church cooperation, the Mennonites, one of the few Christian denominations founded on a theology of radical nonconformity and non-resistance, were left without a substantial theological foundation for resisting Nazism. Let me comment on this just a bit. These people's ancestors paid with their blood for the separation of church and state. That is the reason their ancestors were killed as martyrs. And now, if the Mennonites are going to be a part of the spirit of their times and attend the higher schools of education, religious education, these educators are encouraging them to forsake their past and join with a new spirit of the time with a new union of church and state. That's progress. Church united with state. So, when it comes to conscience issues, the Anabaptist people understood there's an individual conscience, God and I have to give account for myself. But the Anabaptists also understood a collective conscience. The church together has a conscience. And so, because of this public conscience and church conscience, the Anabaptist people were able to maintain themselves as a distinct unit who worked together until now. In contrast to that, the Protestant theology emphasized the individual, God and I. And it was just God and I can shift more easily. So it took a long time for the Anabaptist collective conscience to lose the basic principle of non-resistance. It took 100 years to do that. And so, the Prussian Mennonites had a liberal, individualized theology, but they were conservative in their political views. And so if you put those two together, in this case we get Mennonite German Nazis, but minus the two-kingdom concept. As I shared with you the other evening, the two-kingdom concept is very clearly put out in the Schleitheim Confession. And this is a Swiss-German confession. The Dutch Mennonites did not have this. Okay, so if you take this two-kingdom concept and remove it from the theology, it equals impotence against Satan and recognized by the Nazis. You might say, how in the world do Nazis learn something like that? Well, there are ways. In 1924, this young guy called Adolf Hitler, who had been wounded in World War I, and who sat in prison, who wrote Mein Kampf, had not yet started on his rise to power. But he wrote this back in 1924, "By their fruits ye shall know them, Puritans, Anabaptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, those are the juiciest ones. In each one of them sits the Jewish maggot." A year earlier, he had said this, "The Jews are undoubtedly a race, but not human. They cannot be human in the sense of being an image of God." Now, that's a whole story as to why Adolf Hitler thought about Jews in this way. In 1928, 4 years later, Adolf Hitler says, as he is rising, "We tolerate no one in our ranks who attacks the ideas of Christianity. Our movement is Christian." Remember that. And there he is. That's the man. And I'm going to ask this young man sitting right here, I don't know your name, but what's this thing? Thank you. You knew it right away. Do you know some young people don't know what that is? What does that mean? Well, good try. I think it's just simply the symbol of Nazism and what it stood for. Do you have any idea what it looks like? Where did it come from? Do any of you young men know where that swastika shape comes from? What's it look like?
The faint resemblance to a cross.
Yeah, it's a broken cross. Mm-hmm. Okay, now if you young men would take a black spray can and go out on the bridge and paint one of those, what would happen today? You'd be in big, big trouble. This symbol now has become synonymous with evil and anti-Semitism and all that. It's really bad. But in 1924, a Mennonite West Prussian congregation wrote about the rise of Adolf Hitler. Quote, "God gave our German people a Führer who knows how to unite our nation with God's strength. Our prayers go out to him. May God bless him and arm him with his strength, not only become a leader toward unity, but also a leader for us and for our German people, toward God and our Savior, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." Now, why did they say that? Well, Germany lost World War I. And the Treaty of Versailles blamed Germany for World War I and said Germany has to pay the bill for World War I, which was very unfair. It made Hitler angry. It made all Germany angry. And it demoralized them. And Germany was in the pits of things. And their finances were a mess. The nation had lost its morale. And then a man comes along who offers solutions. He offers a way to make Germany great again. In 1933, the German Mennonites wrote to Adolf Hitler. Now, this slide I just showed you was 1924, who wrote about Adolf Hitler. 9 years later, they write directly to the man, and this is what they say. The conference of the East and West Prussian Mennonites meeting today in Tegenhagen in the Free State of Danzig is grateful for the great uplift which God has given our people through your strength of will, and also pledges its enthusiastic willingness to cooperate with the building of our fatherland with the strength of the gospel true to the motto of our fathers. On other ground, no man can lay a foundation than Jesus Christ. Adolf Hitler wrote back to the Mennonites, "The content of your letter reveals true loyalty to me and your readiness for cooperation, for the cooperation with the construction of the German Reich, and I extend my sincere thanks." The German people commonly believe that the Jews were responsible for the German loss of World War I. And as I said, the Treaty of Versailles unfairly held the Germany responsible for the large war reparations, angering the Germans as well as Adolf Hitler. Thus, Hitler could easily portray the Germans as the victims. Get that? Germans as the victims and Jews as the victimizers. The Jews would need to be dealt with. They're the reason why Germany is in the mess that it is. Now, the Mennonite principles were separation from the world. They're only going to conform to the will of God. They're not going to swear any oath to any earthly ruler, and they are going to maintain non-resistance. That's Mennonite principles. But Nazi principles say we only may have conformity to Nazism. They demanded loyalty through an oath, and they are going to subdue the world forcibly in Hitler's name. Now, you can't put those two together. It's either this or this. Now, the desire to remain in Prussia. These are the people who did not go to Russia. These are the people who did not go to America. These are the people who stayed behind. The desire to remain in Prussia led the Mennonites into a pattern of compromise. Adolf Hitler wrote in his book, "By fighting off the Jews, I am doing the Lord's work. Today I believe that I am acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator." Adolf Hitler promoted the idea of social Darwinism. The strong survive, the weak die off because they lose in the competition. Christianity and its notion of charity should be replaced by the ethic of strength over weakness. Peace, humility, and meekness were weakness. Adolf Hitler wrote, "History will recognize our movement as the great battle for humanity's liberation, a liberation from the curse of Mount Sinai. God is a tyrant who orders one to do the very things one doesn't like." He also wrote, "I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel." Where's Christianity? This is written by a man who led millions into untold evil, including obliterating his victims at the rate of 12,000 persons every single day at the Auschwitz death camp. By 1933, Hitler says this, "One is either a German or a Christian. You can't be both. Either or." One honest German Mennonite, Joseph Gingrich, who is from our side, the Swiss-German side, you can tell by his name, noted in 1934, quote, "The danger is great because we have become faint-hearted and unaccustomed to struggle after a long period of religious peace and freedom, and because we quite naturally bristle at recognizing a danger that will shoo us out of our compliant contentedness, since it may well shatter our religious as well as our economic well-being." And my hat is off to that man. This guy is seeing straight. He is having discernment. But I know nothing else about Joseph Gingrich. Somehow it got recorded somewhere. In 1934, the German Mennonite Conference eliminated a non-resistant position from its written confession of faith. German Mennonites repeatedly hailed Adolf Hitler as the liberating savior from communism. Now, I'm going to pause right there. Now, this is one of the reasons why the Mennonites loved Hitler. Because to the east of them, their relatives in the Soviet Union, in Ukraine, were under the domineering thumb of Joseph Stalin. And Stalin was killing their men. You know, I think by 1935, something like that, half of all the Mennonite men had disappeared, sent up into Siberia or killed. He had his purges. And this was happening to their relatives over in the Soviet Union. But German Mennonites were so pleased they had Hitler. Hitler was an enemy of Stalin. Stalin was an enemy of Hitler. At least they had Hitler. And so they sent humanitarian relief over to Russia. There was a famine. I mean, Bolsheviks took over Russia in 1917. And once the communists came to power, there was a famine, I think, in 1922. And so people in Germany still had. So they shared with the starving people in Russia. But beginning in 1935, the Nazis blocked all the German Mennonite financial assistance to their persecuted brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. And when Hitler made that statement, once again, you can't do both. And so they said, yes, sir. That means they stopped humanitarian aid. Ambrose of Milan said long, long ago, "He who knows evil is being done and does nothing to stop it is guilty with the evildoer." Now, this is kind of a break-in. I copied this out of a book. It says, "In such passages, Heidegger calls on students and others to wholly submit to the will of Hitler, who is said to embody the will of the German people. His call demands a referral of one's will, offering it up in service of a greater will. The individual is called upon to authentically will by sacrificing his or her will to the one great will of the state, a will that is unified in the will of its fascist leader, Adolf Hitler." It's like I just simply surrender my will to something bigger than me, and it is in the form of Adolf Hitler. In these statements from Heidegger's political speeches, we find a call not simply to abandon one's will, but to actively defer it to the towering will of the Führer. That's very significant. At one time, both Jews and Mennonites were welcomed by German princes who needed their tax money. Both groups aroused popular resentment and persecution because of their economic prosperity. Eventually, German political correctness showcased the prosperous Mennonites for their honesty and industry, while declaring that Jewish prosperity undermined German values. An old saying declared, "You have to get up pretty early to hoodwink a Jew, but if you want to bamboozle a Mennonite, you can't even go to bed the night before." So that shows you the class in which they put both Mennonites and Jews. said of the German Mennonites in the 1930s, "This German ethnic mania transformed the public profile of Mennonites, the one-time pesky sect now epitomized Germanness, with its steadfast adherence to thrift, sobriety, piety, honesty, and industry. Perhaps the most significant was the Mennonite preservation of racial purity. No other German free church was lauded with such praise, and the German Mennonites just bask in this praise." Now, I'll tell you why. When the Dutch people came over from Netherlands to Prussia, they were tolerated there. They were given a certain amount of land. They could not buy any new land. And they were told, "You may baptize only your own people. If any of your people marry somebody who is not Mennonite, the resulting children may not be Mennonite." And so this forced the Mennonites to only marry other Mennonites. And by doing so, they kept their racial background pure. And as they are beginning to think about the perfectly pure Aryan race, the Nazi says, "Look at the Mennonites. They've been doing this. They know how to do it. Look at them. Do it that way." And furthermore, if you need more people for a reference, look over into Russia. There's a place over there called Kortitsa and Malashna and all those daughter colonies. They're doing it in islands away from us. But it's being done out there as well as here. And the Mennonites were very pleased that suddenly they become the national example. Adolf Hitler spoke of Germany as a body with himself as the doctor. He wanted to make Germany healthy by eliminating diseased, unhealthy parts of the body. Early on, this meant killing the disabled. But because the Nazis also believed that Jews possessed bad genes, they too came to be portrayed by public health experts and scientists as a threat to racial purity and a healthy nation. Genealogical associations archived and cataloged large volumes of Mennonite ancestral information for determining who to count as Jewish versus Aryan. As a means of ensuring the collective Aryanness of Germany's Mennonite community, genealogical research was extremely effective. Individual members obligated to fill out racial passports were often able to do so with the help of church archivists or other local genealogists. At least one congregation met to fill out race forms as an official church activity. One participant said, "Until now, a Mennonite was considered Aryan without question. A single case would ruin our reputation." But once again, they had it. They just had to record it. And here are Mennonite men from Danzig, tested by the racial anthropologist Otto Aiko in 1931. These are perfect examples of German Aryans. They're all Mennonites. That's what Hitler was looking for. These guys had it. They were the perfect breed. The German Mennonites engaged in anti-Semitic communication, both verbally and print. Now remember, they used to be equal when it comes to economics. But Germany decided that Mennonites are good and Jews are bad. And so now they're going to go in with the political correctness of their day, and they're going to start despising the Jews along with the rest of society. So they engaged in anti-Semitic communication, both verbally and in print. They noted that Jews were a part of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and profited financially from World War I. They agreed that violence should not be used against Jews, but the legal restrictions were proper. This attitude was all the Nazis really needed to implement their final solution. The German Mennonites would be passive and silent as the Holocaust happened in their midst. In contrast, the Quakers, corporately and individually, refused to be passive and silent, actively aiding the Jews where and when they could. Many Mennonite survivors of the Stalinist terror and anti-Kulak and deportation campaigns expressed virulent hatred for both Jews and communists as equivalent evils. Mennonites generally resented, envied, and despised Jews because so many of them seemed to have been found in the ranks of the Soviet secret police and the Communist Party cadre, as well as among the supervisors and managers of collective farms and local government agencies. The Mennonites were in with political correctness. The most harshly persecuted Christian group in Nazi Germany was the Jehovah's Witnesses. Of a population of 20,000, about half spent some time in concentration camps. At least 1,400 died in the camps, and about 250 were executed for refusing to bear arms. The Nazis used the cross and the Bible as they did their work. The Jews ended up crushed and dehumanized, and all the more alienated from the gospel because the symbols of redemption were used by their abusers. Drowning people abused by the life preserver turned to the safer worlds of agnosticism, atheism, or the vague, pluralistic, feel-good spiritualism. And that is the position of most Jews today. They say, there could not have been a God who allowed the Holocaust to happen. If the Holocaust happened, there could not be a God. German Mennonites would only help Jews if it did not put their own lives in jeopardy. Probably the only person who had any chance of hampering Hitler was the Pope, who had the ear of 40 million German Catholics, but he barely said a word. When German forces occupied Rome, he opened his sanctuaries to give refuge to many thousands of non-Aryans, but he was committed to neutrality in his search for peace and feared provoking Hitler, so he opened not his mouth. From 1920 to 1940, one-third of all Russian Mennonites were arrested and disappeared. The watching German Mennonites said in 1936, "The recently resurrected German Reich has become a protective bulwark against the Bolshevik assault. We have remained spared from the horrors suffered by comrades that share our faith and our racial stock in the Soviet Union." The man who did that, Joseph Stalin, said, "Death is the solution to all problems. No man, no problem." Rather simplistic, but it was effective. This man, Joseph Stalin, killed 20 million of his own people through purges, abuse, and starvation. In 1937, Hitler ordered all German children into the government schools. He said, "The youth of today is ever the people of tomorrow. For this reason, we have set before ourselves the task of inoculating our youth with the spirit of this community. At a very young age, at an age when human beings are still unperverted and are therefore unspoiled, this Reich stands and is building itself up for the future upon its youth. And this new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing." And here are some other quotes from Adolf Hitler. "He alone who owns the youth gains the future." Rather wise. "How fortunate for leaders that men do not think." It's always more difficult to fight against faith than against knowledge. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. In 1937, Eberhard Arnold's German Hutterite community was forcibly dissolved and its members deported from Germany. To distance themselves from the Hutterites, the German Mennonites wrote, quote, "The Hutterites belong neither to German Mennonite churches nor to any other organization within our Free German Mennonite Church." In other words, to be politically correct, we have no connections to these people. Previously they did. In 1938, official church president Friedrich Werner gave orders that on Adolf Hitler's 49th birthday in April, all Protestant pastors must swear an oath of allegiance to the Führer and the Reich Chancellor, which was his two titles. Werner's decree included the words, quote, "Anyone who refuses to take the oath is to be dismissed." German Christians took the oath immediately with joyful hearts and in obedience to inner command. And once again, the German Mennonite Church joined the Protestant flow and said, "Yes, sir." Official German Mennonite publications supported the Third Reich, praised the Nazi armies, rejoiced in their victories, and called for Mennonites to lay down their lives for their friends. With the 1939 reunion of Danzig with Germany, the Prussian Mennonites praised the act as nothing short of the mercy and will of God. In a few short years, the victories crumbled into ashes and bitter tears, and I'll shortly tell you some more about that. This is what Danzig looked like in 1945, 6 years after that was written. Until it ceased publication in 1941, the German Mennonite periodical, however you pronounce that, continued to laud Hitler and his policies, as well as to provide theological and biblical reasons for supporting them. These are official Mennonite publications. Adolf Hitler said in 1941, "I can't break the church over my knee. It has to be left to rot like a gangrenous limb. But the healthy youth belong to us." When the Nazis permitted the German Mennonites freedom to exist as a church only if they abandoned all critical public commentary, they had no anchor, and once again they said, "Yes, sir." While the public face of German Mennonites consistently supported the Nazi regime, this was not a result of cold calculation. Neither did it take place in the absence of soul searching. Nonetheless, their faith failed to provide a perspective that transcended the trappings of their culture and their era. In other words, Mennonites did not coldly decide they're going to become Nazis. They had already compromised so far, so much, that they had no strength anymore. So whenever the pressures of Nazism came, they just couldn't do anything else but say, "Yes, sir." The biggest fall of the Mennonites was not any immediate error. Instead, it was the natural consequence of years of gradual theological adaptations and compromises to better fit within the German community. So that not one able-bodied Mennonite man of draft age in all of Germany refused conscription. There were three Mennonites in Holland who refused conscription, but in Germany, none. Some even joined the notorious SS, and now here's where I need to stop and tell you a story. This story is included here in this book, and I'll just tell you it in brief. There was a man by the name of, I think it was Heinrich Wiens, who to his credit renounced his Mennonite membership to do this. But he volunteered to become an SS man. And his job was, he had a new truck that he was to take out onto the field. His job was to go to a Jewish village and tell the Jews in the village that they have a week to sign all their names, give their information. And at the end of that week, they were supposed to appear with their belongings at another place, at the edge of town or someplace, to be transported. So once that all registered was done, they picked these people up in trucks and took them out to some place. And then he said, okay, I want the first, however many, 25 people, you take off all your clothes and get in that truck. And so what could they do? There were German Nazis around them with guns, so they had to. Got in the truck, shut the doors, turned the gas on. I think it was just exhaust. I think they suffocated them with carbon monoxide. And I don't know about the other part of the gas. I think that's the way it was. But anyway, they just drove around the field until everybody in the back had died. They would come back to a pit that was close by, and they would tell some of the Jews that were standing there, all right, pull all these dead bodies out and throw them in that pit. Now the next 25, take off all your clothes and get in that truck. And they did that until all the people were killed. The people who were pulling the dead bodies out, after they were done, they got in the truck and they suffered the same fate. After that job was done with that Jewish village, they went to the next village and repeated the process. And then went to the next village and repeated the process. This man was a former Mennonite. How in the world can you do that? Where is that person's conscience? Furthermore, why do you think they told them to take their clothes off? Do you have any idea? Do you have an idea? Well, that was a part of their effort. That was especially at the camps where they were killing them. But there's another reason. They were frugal. If they took their clothes off, they could use them for somebody else. And whenever they killed these people in these gas chambers at these camps, before they would actually cremate them, they would open their mouths and dig out all their gold teeth. And they would shave all their people's heads, especially women's heads, so that, and there are pictures of piles of hair, so that you can make upholstery. They didn't spare anything. I mean, they used a human being to the tilt. In fact, there's a story about an SS officer's wife who wanted a lampshade made from a particular Jew who had tattoos on him. So they skinned this Jew and dried the skin and put it on her lampshade. Now, I don't know how normal people can live in a living room with a tattooed human skin and feel normal. I don't get that. Nice-looking people. I gave this presentation over by Grantsville, Maryland, and when I did so, they said, you need to meet Ruth Yoder. So I went to Ruth Yoder, and I talked to her, and these are her parents. Her father was an SS man. This is her mother, Goethe. Look, nice people, don't they? There's the family. This is Ruth herself. This is her father. This is her mother. I think this is her grandfather. When he went off, his job was not to kill Jews. His job was to be a protector of a politician. But he also did other things. And fortunately, for some reason, this entire family survived the war. When he came back, he would not talk about the stuff that he did. This woman who lived, the family was just east of Danzig. And whenever the Russians were coming, as World War II was ending, the Russians were coming, this lady and her family had to flee in front of these Russians. And when they got to the northern coast of Germany, they got on boats to try to go to Denmark. And they were on a barge. And this barge had no railing. And this mother kept her family together, all these children, including a baby who had been born after. No, it must have been this little girl. But she put all her children on this barge with a whole bunch of other people and then put a sheet all around them like this so that nobody would fall off. And if one person fell off, they would all fall off. And if they were hit by a bomb or hit a mine, they would all die. And while they were on this, another boat somewhere right near them hit a mine and everybody died. But this family did not. Now, Ruth says of her father, she says, I do not believe that man was a Christian. And she talks about the German church experience. And it was cold, and it was formal, it was just a church, I guess you could say. So why did the German Mennonites enthusiastically support Adolf Hitler? Number one, he provided religious direction. Number two, he improved the farming economy. Number three, he created a stronger central government, political help. Number four, he worked to destroy communism. And number five, he offered hope to a discouraged Germany. And number six, he offered a comprehensive solution to German problems. He made Germany great again. All right. In early 1945, like I said before, as the war was ending, and the Soviet Union was pushing west, the Mennonites of the former West Prussia were the hapless victims of the advancing Russian army. A general fear of being caught by the invaders led many to flee to the west, and those who remained or waited too long to escape, usually the sick, the young, and the elderly, suffered mightily at the hands of the Russian army. Starvation, rape, bodily injury, torture, deportation to Russia, loss of life were among the horrific events of those days. It is said that after this happened, the hospitals were full of women to have abortions. That's how common rape was. Congregations and families were torn apart. Most would never see their homeland again. The vibrant communities of Mennonites in West Prussia were utterly destroyed. Now let me tell you one other story. This was the Reimer family that I just showed you. After World War II ended, these German Mennonites had to go someplace. They couldn't stay in Germany. So they went to Uruguay, to Paraguay, and to Argentina. My daughter, Violet, and her husband, Verlin, moved to Uruguay. And I went down to visit when she had her heart operation. And when I was there, I said, I would like to visit one of these German Nazis. And they said, well, yeah, we know where some are. So I said, they were going on some business anyway. So may I go along? So we went out, found these German communities, and went in, knocked on a man's door, and he came out. His name was Claussen, John Claussen, I think. And, of course, it was in old English. I couldn't understand what was being said. But the man said, come on in. So we went in. And they fed us a meal. And so he brought up this subject right here. And he said, yeah. He says, my mother was 15 when that happened. But she said, my mother said that Nazi thing, that was not a good thing. And so that family did not enter into the spirit of Nazism. And this John Claussen family had no spirit of Nazism at all that I could see. And I felt good about that, that spirit was no longer there. However, are you aware that in Paraguay, in some place, maybe to this very night, there's a picture of Adolf Hitler above their speaking stand in their community hall? There are Mennonites in Paraguay today who still respect Adolf Hitler. After the Nazi sorry. Got mixed up. The consequences for the Prussian Mennonites, rather than having their insecure fears of being expelled from Germany by the Nazis realized, Prussian Mennonites found a much worse fate at the hands of this advancing Soviet army. And by the summer of 1945, when they went through, the Prussian Mennonites lost their 400-year home in the region. Their graves are there to this day. Maybe some of their houses are there, but there are no Mennonites there at all. It was wiped out. The consequences for the German Mennonites of abandoning their New Testament principles was complicity with the Nazi regime and being collaborators in the Jewish Holocaust. Okay, now you tell me, what are you supposed to do with yourself if the war ends and you find this truth on your hand? How do you live with yourself? How do you come to terms with that? After the Nazi atrocities became fully known to the public in 1945, let me pause right there. The Allies, when they went into those concentration camps and death camps and found the situation as it was, they decided, we will not just report this to the media. They got the local Germans and marched them through the camps so those local Germans could see with their own eyes what the Nazis did. And the local Germans many times could not believe that such a thing happened in their midst, in their backyards, and they hardly knew much about what was going on. Jews are rather smart people. Anti-Jewish pogroms have been a fact of history for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Holocaust was the worst one. Every so often, anti-Semitism arises. But the Jews decided, look, we are going to gather materials, artifacts, and we are going to have a memorial built so that we have hard evidence so nobody could ever deny that this ever happened. And so they built a Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. How many of you have ever been there? Wonderful. I don't personally think any young person's education is complete until he visits the Holocaust Museum. Now, I know Kansas is pretty far away, and so I have to give you a little bit of space, but there is no museum around like it. When we visited, before it opened, there was a long line of people waiting for the doors to open. And once the doors were open, all these people went in. And once you're inside, all those people, it is this quiet. How many of you found the same way when you were there? It is so awful. What you see is so awful. You can't believe it. In 1978, in the northwest side of Chicago, in Skokie, Illinois, once again, there got to be anti-Semitism arising. There was an anti-Semitic spirit in the area. And so the Jews said, okay, we've got to build a memorial here. And so they built the Holocaust Museum of Chicago. It's not quite as good as the one in D.C., but it's pretty good. And once again, they have all these artifacts so that nobody can deny. There's one place in there where they have a little sign on the door, caution, children under age 12, not recommended. Because, I'll just tell you what it is. Somebody was wearing a movie camera and went to a place where Nazis were killing Jews and shooting them. And they fall into a pit, and you see this with your own eyes. And I told one of my students, if you can't handle this, don't go in. She did. She seemed to be able to handle it okay. It is the most revolting thing that you can imagine. But the Jews were right. A few years ago, the president of Iran denied that the Holocaust has ever happened. Okay, the Mennonites have said, okay, yep, we know. But what do you do with yourself if you discover that you're on the wrong side of history? So, they found themselves battling the demon of their own creation in a stark realization of having compromised their fundamental tenets of faith by their alliance with one of the most evil regimes in human history. How can this be that Anabaptist descendants participated in one of the most evil regimes in human history? It's a huge irony, but it happened. It took 30 years before the writings addressing the Nazi past came to be written by German Mennonites. And for many, this was a very painful process. They couldn't even talk about it or write it for 30 years. And finally, they said this. One of the Nazi concentration camps, Stutthof, was located east of Danzig in the midst of Mennonite farmhouses. A large number of smaller camps belonging to this KZ belonged to this KZ also, and the inhabitants of the area often saw starving prisoners in their striped dress on their way to the places of their forced labor, working for Mennonite farmers. In this same article that I referred to at the earlier, this certain man who was at this conference says this. He shared childhood memories of a long series of trains and wagons going by his house, transporting Jews to a nearby concentration camp at Stutthof. Quote, there was no question about what was happening there, he said. Dreidiger also recalled Jews from the Stutthof camp being forced to serve as slave laborers on surrounding farms, including those of Mennonites, and being locked into the stall of his family's barn at night. You can read more about this later if you're interested. In 1995, how many years is that after 1945? That's 50 years. And this is the first official statement that the German Mennonites made. They published this. Most Mennonites in Germany gave in to the temptations of Nazism and sacrificed the peace witness. Very often they valued their commitment to the state higher than their duties to Mennonite brothers and sisters in the Netherlands and France. And that means that's an acknowledgement that German Mennonites actually fought against Dutch and French Mennonites in the war. Nearly all Mennonites remain silent in the face of Nazi crimes against Jews and others. We can only plead for forgiveness with the words of the Lord's Prayer. But, said of a former Mennonite Nazi in 2001, 16 years ago, the majority have not recognized the need for repentance of any kind. The Mennonite open-mindedness toward the German Reich, the Third Reich, was possible because when Mennonites left the early separation and integrated into a Protestant, the Mennonite open-mindedness toward the Third Reich was possible when Mennonites left the early separation and integrated into a Protestant society, and this pattern has not changed since 1945. In other words, they have come to terms with what they did, but they have really not corrected the problem. Why did the German Mennonites become Nazis? They were the heirs of groups who, after long centuries of being disadvantaged, had now made tremendous gains and had flourished quickly after adapting to German society. They had long since lost any connection to the critical stance of the First Anabaptists, and their understanding of their own history was revisionist. They adopted the predominant Protestant theology of Lutheranism, according to which the head of the state is acting as God's instrument, although there was also some dissent. In general, however, German Mennonites of this time separated their personal religious beliefs from their political opinions. Simon Wiesenthal, after the war, was a Nazi hunter. And he went around the world trying to find former Nazis and bring them to justice. He says this: "There is no denying that Hitler and Stalin are alive today. They are waiting for us to forget, because that is what makes possible the resurrection of these monsters." And this is one of the reasons why I'm sharing this with you today. Non-cooperation with evil is every bit a moral obligation as cooperation with good. Evil prospers when good men do nothing about it. Now, there's another corresponding story in Paraguay, but I'm not going to bore you with it, but this is a book. That's a picture of a book. While this is all going on in Germany, there was a Mennonite who went to Paraguay to try to convince the Mennonites in Paraguay to support Nazism. He was somewhat successful. He actually created a division among the Paraguayan Mennonites. While this was going on, the CIA stopped Ori Miller, who was on an MCC trip someplace in his travels, and interrogated him about what's going on down there in Paraguay. And so the book is entitled Mennonite and Nazi. Okay, that ends what I have to say. Is there any questions that any of you might have? I'm wondering something. How many of you here are old enough to remember World War II? Wow, you're one of the few places I've talked about this. Okay. We have to tell the story because these young people know nothing about this. You went through it. And so if you don't experience it, you've got to tell the story. Now, I'm just curious, does anybody have any questions about anything? Or any comments about anything? Yes, Leroy. Thank you. Thank you.
We are implicated in that. And so that would be the one thing that I would say. It's very good to make a specific story. But not to sort of say nobody else was involved, and nobody else was told.
Thank you. Yes. Yes. And you're welcome to search it out yourself. In fact, you folks are in a unique position. You have Bethel College not too far from here, where you could probably find all this plus much more. Okay. Yes?
I'll just make this as an observation. When I first saw this 2 years ago, it didn't hit me as hard as it did this year.
Why? I understand. And I probably should just keep my mouth shut. History is still happening. And those of you who are sharp, you heard some suggestions, and I don't want to go any further with that. Okay? Yes?
If I could just clarify something. We sing this song, Pray to Our Fathers. And yet when I moved to the Holocaust Museum, the only Christian group separated, they had a special badge for Jehovah's Witnesses because they were specially born.
Amen. Amen. Young people, understand and encounter Christ and learn your story and choose to be a part of the redemptive story of God's people in the world. There's more to do than you'll ever get done. Why waste your energies on all kinds of other stuff? Thank you, Japheth. Anything else? Thank you for your attention.